Welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our show, a conversation with an excellent national journalist and author who makes his home right here in Baltimore, Alec McGillis, a reporter for ProPublica, has a new book that's out tomorrow about Amazon, whose iron grip on business makes it not just an economic powerhouse, but one of the most influential entities in American culture writ large. The book is called Fulfillment, Winning and Losing in a One-Click America. Alec McGillis joins me tomorrow here on Midday. Joining me now is another experienced and acclaimed journalist, Paul Glastris. He's been the editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly for 20 years. The Monthly has long been one of the most respected journals in the political sphere. Glastris also spent 10 years as a correspondent and editor at U.S. News and World Report. And from 1998 to 2001, he was a special assistant and senior speechwriter in the Clinton administration, where he wrote more than 200 speeches for President Bill Clinton. Paul Glastris joins us on Zoom. Paul, welcome to the show. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So I'm interested in your perspective as a former speechwriter for a president. What did you think of Mr. Biden's address Thursday night? First time he addressed the nation from the White House. What do you think he should have said? What do you think he did say? And, you know, as a person who knows what goes into that process, how do you think he did?
Well, you know, nothing helps a speech more than good material. And the material that Joe Biden had to work with was of the kind every president would dream of. It was the one-year anniversary of his predecessor's not very well-received Oval Office address at the beginning of the pandemic. It was the day he signed a nearly $2 trillion relief bill that will put money in the pockets of average Americans, especially those who have been hardest hit by the pandemic. And it was happening at a time when people's spirits have been buoyed by the more rapid than expected rollout of the vaccine for the virus. So it was a tremendous opportunity for him. I think he seized the opportunity extremely well. Had I been in the room, I might have lopped off the last, 20-30% of the speech. I thought it went on a little long, but basically it was very, very well done. And it led with what is Joe Biden's strongest capacity, which is validating and expressing in ways people can understand pain people are feeling. You know, the great empathy factor that people talk about. That moment when he looked into the camera, put his arms on the desk and told the American people, I need you. I need your help. I need you to take this vaccine. Very, very effective.
And that's interesting because I was really taken by that moment as well. And when he does that, you know, his elbows resting on the pulpit and he lowers his voice and almost whispers and says, I need you. I need you. Given the political polarity that we've long had now, certainly over the last 5 years or so, is that going to resonate? I mean, what does a Trump voter or a Republican, even from the so-called business wing of the Republican Party or the normal wing of the Republican Party, some people call it, is that plea, that very personal, intimate plea from a Democratic president and this particular Democratic president, is that gonna land?
I don't know. I don't think anyone knows. Bill Clinton used to have a saying, we ought to get caught trying, by which he meant, let's put up a fight. And, even if we know, maybe we're going to lose, because the very act of being seen as working toward the right end, the righteous end, is itself you know, politically advantageous. So you get to do the right thing and get rewarded for it. I think there is no downside that I can think of for Joe Biden sincerely asking people on both sides of the aisle to get behind his policies and to act in ways that, you know, the chief scientists are saying are responsible. That's all that he can really do. And, you know, whether people on the other side listen to him, whether they, you know, Fox News and some of the other programs kind of spin it as you know, a fake news or whatever, you know, he can't at this point control that.
Paul Glasters is a former speechwriter for President Bill Clinton and the editor-in-chief of Washington Monthly. He joins us on Zoom. You can join our conversation as well, 410-662-8780. It's Midday on Politics. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. To follow me on Twitter, it's @TomHallWYPR. So, Paul, I wonder, it's still early in the administration. You mentioned that, you know, the president did have a lot of good material to work with, some good news to announce and some very optimistic predictions about, you know, where we'll be on the 4th of July, et cetera. But still, I wonder, the process of writing a speech this early in the administration probably can't be particularly easy. I mean, it's going to be easier, you know, 50 days from now and 150 days from now when people have sort of settled in. What do you know about the process of how this speech came together? And, you know, what do you think? Obviously, I mean, I guess you think the results were pretty good.
Well, you know, those are two very good observations, and I'm not sure I have the experience to answer them. I think you're right that early in administration, the voice of the new president, the then candidate, is still waiting to be defined. And I don't personally have any knowledge of how this particular speech was put together. I can hazard some guesses, though. And it kind of, you know, goes to the first question. Joe Biden's been in this a long time. He's been in this business a long time. He's been senator, a vice president. He's very, you know, unlike most recent presidents, he's probably more comfortable in the role and probably has more of a head start in defining his voice than others. Moreover, he's had people around him for years, people who've been his chief of two different individuals who were his chiefs of staff in the Obama White House, Bruce Reed and Ron Klain, are right there with him in the West Wing. Bruce in particular, I worked with both of them in the Clinton administration, particularly closely with Bruce. Bruce has written for the Washington Monthly. He's a fabulous speechwriter, and I kind of sensed his hand all over this speech, even if he didn't himself write it. So he's got a lot of people with communication skills who know him very, very well.
You wrote a piece about Biden's hidden weaponry, and I found it fascinating because you brought up two things that you think the president should pursue, and I will be the first to admit that they are not two things that I would have thought of or certainly would have thought to put at the top of the list. One is anti-monopolism, and the other is empowering local jurisdictions. Explain why you think those are two things that President Biden could do and how that would help advance his agenda moving forward.
Well, the premise of the story is that even if Joe Biden has, the Democrats have, a you know, 50 senators in effective control of the body, unless they get rid of the filibuster, they aren't going to get much through the legislature, through Congress, you know, that isn't done, you know, on those occasions, few of them, where they can do things through reconciliation. So a lot of what people in the Democratic Party and the progressive movement, and frankly, a lot of the American people want done, from infrastructure to voting rights support and so forth, probably can't get done. And that's a recipe for frustration and, you know, throwing in the towel. If what you think Biden needs to do, and I'm sure he believes this, is transformational change of the country, of the economy. What we at the magazine have written quite a bit on, and what is in this piece you mentioned, is the argument that on his own, without asking permission from any Republican senators, without getting Mitch McConnell's permission, without having to change the filibuster rules, he can have profound influence both politically and on policy through his own actions, through his own executive power. Anti-monopoly, the taking on of consolidated industries, is one of them. And, you know, you're seeing already on Capitol Hill a lot of interest in pursuing a rolling back or basically a re-engagement with the old policies, the old statutes that governed this country for a century until we abandoned them in the 80s, of making markets more competitive and getting rid of the dominance of firms like Facebook or Google or Walmart or Amazon, you know, that literally control whole markets. And that is one thing that the president, through his control of agencies, from the judiciary, from the Justice Department, to the Ag Department, to his appointments at the FTC and the FCC, can really push forward. And there'll be fights in the courts and so forth. But, you know, when you think about what are the major structural problems in this economy for years, it's rising inequality, it's flat wages to, you know, even falling wages, and essentially over generations, downward mobility. A lot of that has to do with fewer employers. If you're a wage earner in an industry with lots of employers, and you can, you know, bounce from one to another and play one off the other and get a raise. They're going to compete for your skills and knowledge. If you're in an industry with one or two players, nobody's competing for your knowledge, and the employer has no reason to increase your wages. So there's no mystery as to why wages have gone down. And, you know, we have less of an innovative economy, less new technologies, less new jobs and wealth creation when there's less entrepreneurship. So, you know, it's not something he can change immediately, but it's levers that he has right now to begin the change that we need. And on the local angle, look, if you look around the country, and you'll see small towns and big cities all over this country wanting to do things that Washington won't let them do, that their states won't let them do. There are towns all over this country, for instance, that have tried to raise their minimum wage. Now, ideally, we would raise the minimum wage in Washington, but that doesn't look like it's going to happen. But why not let a local community raise its minimum wage if that's what they want to do? Well, state governments, predominantly those controlled by Republicans, literally will pass laws saying a local government can't raise its minimum wage. It can't pass a piece of legislation saying we're going to protect gay and lesbian citizens in our community. It can't ban oil drilling and fracking within its borders. So there's been this wave of constraint that Republicans have put on state and local governments. And there's a lot Joe Biden can do on his own to provide municipalities with more freedom, more ability to govern the way they see fit. I'll give you a couple of examples. He can, and you know, this is one that ought to appeal to Republicans. He can say, we are going to allow local communities to decide whether they are going to take more refugees than they would normally be allotted or not. You know, some small towns desperately need refugees because their downtowns are dying and the refugees bring in, you know, fill hard to, you know, the fill the jobs of that others.
We had that happening here in Baltimore. Yeah, we had that happen. You know, the couple of the last few mayors have said, you know, bring them on. We need more folks.
Yeah. Absolutely. Why not give local communities the freedom to ask for more? That's just one example. And that would appeal not just to the Baltimores of the world, but to the, you know, small towns in Western Maryland. And if they don't want them, the citizens can say we don't want them. And that is empowering. Mm-hmm. That gives, you know, a lot of the reason people don't like our immigration policies is not that they don't particularly like immigrants. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. It's that they feel the borders aren't under control. They feel that they have no ability as citizens to have a say over how many and who gets in the country. Well, this would give people a say. And that, I just don't see any downside to that. And I think he's going to do things like that, but we'd like to see him do more.
Paul Glasters is a former speechwriter for President Bill Clinton and the editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly. We'll have more with Paul Glasters on the other side of a quick break. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. You can tweet us as well. And before we go to a break, it is our practice here on Midday to read the names of people who have lost their lives to violence in Baltimore City and to list their names on the Midday webpage. We do so to stand in witness to their untimely deaths and to remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. So far in 2021, 54 people have been victims of homicide in our city. Baltimore police have released the identity of a person whose homicide was first reported last month. Irvin Talley was 16 years old. Three people who died within the last few months from injuries they sustained earlier have been identified. Preston Hill was shot in 1984. He died last December from complications caused by his injury, and last week, city medical examiners ruled his death a homicide. Preston Hill was 64 years old. Kendrick Hasty was shot in 2016. He died last November from those injuries. That death has now been also determined to be a homicide. Kendrick Hasty was 33 years old. Aubrey Faulkner, a toddler, died in October of last year. Her death from a narcotics overdose has been ruled a homicide. Aubrey Faulkner was 3 years old. Seven other homicide victims who lost their lives over the past 2 weeks have been identified by Baltimore police. They are Dominic Simmons, age 40, Courtney Rice, age 46, Jamal Pinchback, age 28, Terry Williams, age 18, Renard Priolo, age 30, Trayvon Hutton, age 32, and Jaleel Jones. He was 15 years old. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, it's Midday on Politics. My guest is the editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly, Paul Glasters. He served in that role since 2001. About a year ago, the Monthly published an expose about Maryland Governor Larry Hogan that raised questions about some road, highway, and bridge projects that have been undertaken during the governor's two terms that are in proximity to real estate projects that the Hogan Real Estate Brokerage Firm is involved with. The governor, who remains hugely popular and is accustomed to positive press coverage, dismissed the Washington Monthly as a blog and contended that any potential conflicts of interest had been fully vetted by the State Ethics Board. The article was by Eric Cortalesa. Paul Glasters is with us until the top of the hour. You can join us as well, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, our Twitter handle at midday WIPR. So, Paul, I do want to ask you some more about the national scene and Joe Biden, but what's your take on Larry Hogan and his enduring popularity? I mean, what was the feedback you got to the piece that you published, you know, as I say, about a year ago, you know, with showing some linkage between the location of some of the big highway and road projects and some of the projects that his real estate company was developing? Anything happen on that, or did that all roll off him like a Teflon duck?
Well, there was quite a bit of reaction. I think a lot of people were, you know, waiting for something like this and kind of amazed that it hadn't come out earlier. And you know, there were complaints based on our reporting written up by Public Citizen and some other groups, and then some action in the Maryland legislature to revamp the rules under which governors have to report their conflicts of interest. I think the COVID, you know, thing hit right after that, and it was tabled, but my guess is that'll come back. So I think we haven't heard the end of that story. But I think you're right. I think Governor Hogan is immensely popular. He's as popular or more so with Democrats than Republicans. And I think the national press, it honestly is so hungry for Republicans who are what you know called normal, right? Who seem to play by the same set of rules that Republicans used to play by, you know, who, for instance, wear masks and recognize the dangers of COVID and, you know, call Donald Trump a liar when he lies, all of which apply to Larry Hogan, that they're all kind of rooting for the guy. And I sort of can't blame them. But when he, you know, he's gotten some pretty good, easy press as a result of that. And that's, you know, why the Washington Monthly, which is not normally covering Maryland politics with any depth, was the one that had to do that story, because mainstream, you know, the Sun and the Washington Post and some of the others just have not been looking as carefully as I think they probably should.
One of the other issues that was somewhat controversial is when the governor first came out with an executive order about voting and how voting was going to take place in the primary in June and then in the general election in November. And after some negotiation, they decided to have, you know, voting centers instead of polling places. The governor had originally wanted all polling places to be open, calling it, you know, a move to increase voting participation. But Republicans writ large nationally are introducing just tons of bills to limit how people can vote, when people can vote, and what's necessary to be able to vote. They're putting up hurdles to voting across the country. Now, I'm going to be talking to Representative John Sarbanes on Wednesday about his bill, H.R. 1, which you alluded to before the break, which includes, you know, provisions for voting rights. But is this, do you think, a winning strategy for Republicans to try to so saliently limit people's ability to cast ballots?
I think it's frankly a crazy position for them to be in. First, because it just puts them on a morally very questionable side, right? I mean, you know, in what universe is trying to limit people's access to the franchise a good thing as a matter of principle? But second, I'm not even sure it's going to work. You know, we've seen time after time when individual groups are targeted for disenfranchisement, which frankly, African Americans have been, students have been, there are laws on the books in a number of states like Texas that say, as a student, you can't use your student ID to vote because they have ID laws. But if you have a hunting license, well, that's good, right? That'll work. I mean, literally that kind of suppression of the vote. And what it winds up doing is riling people up. People don't like things taken away from them, especially the right to vote. So you've seen, you know, African-American voting percentages go up. You've seen student voting go up in the face of this harassment. So that doesn't mean that, you know, we should leave them to do it. But it does go to your question. Is it good politics for Republicans to do it? I think it's terrible politics, but I think from one point of view, it might make sense. And that is, if you're not winning majorities of the vote, right, which Republicans are not pretty consistently, your best bet of holding power is to keep voting down. And hopefully more of the other guy's voters will not vote than yours. We'll see.
Yeah, we should make it also clear that here in Maryland, the trend is going exactly the opposite way. The General Assembly in the process of passing a number of bills that will make voting early and voting by mail easier. So here in Maryland, people are increasing, or the legislature is increasing people's accessibility to the ballot. Just got a couple minutes left, Paul. Andrew Cuomo in New York. With each passing day, we get more allegations about sexual harassment. The allegations about his handling of the nursing home statistics continue, and more people line up calling for his resignation. In terms of the Democratic Party writ large, are Mr. Cuomo's problems going to interfere with President Biden's efforts to move on from the COVID relief bill to things like infrastructure or voting rights or an immigration reform bill?
I don't see the linkage between Andrew Cuomo's fate and Joe Biden's agenda. That's one governor in a state that is probably outsized in influence and certainly population, but, you know, doesn't really hit what happens to Andrew Cuomo won't really affect, you know, whether Republicans support a bill in Congress or not, or whether Joe Biden can use executive authority to crack down on monopolies. I think, whether Andrew Cuomo, you know, is even governor a few months from now, I think is very much a live question.
How about the complaint that people on the right are lodging towards Mr. Biden? And again, we have about 30 seconds left, that he's not held a press conference yet. And it's some 60 days or something into his presidency. It's later than many other presidents when it comes to, you know, engaging directly with the press. You think that's going to be a problem?
No. It's kind of rich coming from, you know, a party, you know, the president. They defended President Trump's lack of press conferences that went on a lot longer. And I do think Joe Biden will have a press conference pretty soon. He's getting, you know, I'd like, as a journalist, I'd like to see him do more press conferences. But, you know, we will see it. It's still a little early.
Paul Glasters is a former speechwriter for President Bill Clinton. He's the editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly. We've got a link to Paul's work in the monthly at WIPR.org/midday. Thanks so much, Paul. Really enjoyed it. And I hope we can do it again sometime.
Same here, Tom. I really enjoyed it, too.
Thank you. That's it for us today. Tomorrow, a conversation about a new book that chronicles the rise of Amazon in Seattle and around the world. So what does Amazon's unparalleled success mean for consumers, workers, businesses, and American culture? Alec McGillis has written a terrific book about the company that has an imprint in many, many areas of American life. It's called Fulfillment: Winning and Losing in a One-Click America. Alec McGillis joins me tomorrow here on Midday. Midday's director and engineer is Luke Spicknell. Our senior producer is Rob Sivak. Jamila Krempel is WIPR's digital content director. Austin Coughlin from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Midday theme music. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks again to everybody who was part of our spring membership campaign last week. We really appreciate you. And we will see you tomorrow. Have a great day.
You're tuned to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.